Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we want to find out why Irish migrants to England remained an underclass for so long and were on average 50% poorer than their English counterparts. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com. No Irish need apply, The Economic History of the Irish in England is the wonderful new temporary exhibition at the Epic Museum in Dublin. Inspired by this exhibition, in tonight's show we want to find out how Irish migrants built modern Britain, yet faced deep inequality, poverty and discrimination for generations. From famine-era labourers to today's high achievers, it's a story that reshapes how we understand migration, identity and opportunity across two centuries. And to help me tell this story, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Neil Cummins is Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics. His groundbreaking research seeks to generate answers for many of the burning questions regarding the origin of the modern world, and his research has provided much of the big data for this research exhibition. Professor Cormac O'Groda is an internationally respected economic historian and Professor Emeritus of Economics at University College Dublin. He has written extensively on a wide range of areas, including the Great Irish Famine, and co-wrote the article with Neil Cummins, which led to this exhibition. Dr. Christopher Cassan is the Engagement and Impact Lead at the LSE Department of Economic History and is the creator of this new EPIC exhibition. An expert on food and history, the history of citizenship and Irish emigration, he presents the Ireland's Edge podcast and is the author of Food, Religion and Communities in Early Modern Europe. And then later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Louise Ryan, Senior Professor of Sociology at London Metropolitan University and Director of the Global Diversities and Inequalities Research Centre there. And she's the author of the book Social Networks and Migration and the co-author with Gráinne McPollin and Neha Doshi of Irish Nurses in the NHS and Oral History. Well, you're all very welcome. And Christopher, I might begin with you and a question about what inspires you to tell this story.
Thanks very much, Patrick. I suppose it's something that speaks to almost everyone and every family in Ireland. It's something that we all have either personal experience of or through our families, through our parents and grandparents, the experience of having relatives in England or having lived in England ourselves. And when I heard about Neil and Cormac's amazing research, it was something that I sort of immediately wanted to be involved in sharing that story with a wider audience, because I think it's a history that too often has been forgotten or perhaps undervalued in the sense that it doesn't maybe have the kind of excitement of the grand story of the Irish in America. And having lived in England myself and my grandparents having immigrated in the 1930s, it was something that I thought was a very apt time to try and share a big economic history story with the wider public in both Ireland and Britain.
And I love the title of the exhibition because there's a very interesting question mark there. No Irish need apply. And then the question mark.
That's right. Yeah, the question mark was very important to us when we were coming up with the idea, because we didn't, first of all, we didn't want it to seem unfairly provocative, because this is a story that is quite complex. It's something that reveals a great deal of poverty and disadvantage and struggle for Irish people in England. But at the same time, it also reveals the new lives that they made for themselves, the contributions that they made to English society, the opportunities that they found there that for many generations they simply couldn't find at home. So the question mark really, I think, shows the duality of that experience, which I think talking to anyone who has had the experience of living in England, especially if you talk to older relatives, people who went in the 50s and so on, that duality is kind of at the heart of the whole thing, because it was something that was both a positive and a negative, and something that they have quite complicated feelings about. So we really wanted to capture that in the title of the exhibition.
I'm struck by what you said there. You said it's a quite complex story, and it is a complex story. And yet you've been able to tell that story in a really creative, imaginative way, using oral histories, using that wonderful 1965 film, The Irishman. Tell me maybe about how you approach telling the story.
I suppose something that economic historians often feel is that our field is maybe not as publicly visible as it should be, in the sense that a lot of what economic history talks about are things that are very relevant in public debate, in policy debate, in current affairs and so on. But maybe it's not often taken as seriously or given as much visibility as it should. And so we wanted to try and tell a big economic history story in a way that communicated with a much wider public. So rather than just presenting sort of facts and figures, we wanted to have the data visualizations be more engaging, to try and tell a story, to explain the kind of results that Neil and Cormac found, but also to explain the methods that they used, to show the kind of records that they used, to think, to see how economic historians think through a big problem. And then, as you say, to try and use things like oral history recordings with the nurses, with Irish people who went to England in the 50s and 60s, and with Philip Donlan's amazing film, to show the real people behind those big graphs. Because Neil and Cormac really have done something quite extraordinary in terms of using millions of archival documents and tracking people and families and generations over, you know, nearly two centuries. So it was very important for us to be able to show that big picture story, but also to bring the people behind that so that people can kind of relate to the real people that are contained in these documents and visualizations.
Okay, Neil, let's talk about this remarkable research then, because only last year in 2025 in the Journal of Economic History, you and Cormac published this remarkable article on the Irish in England, and that provides a lot of the data for this exhibition. So maybe talk to me about the approach, about the methods, about this way you're able to bring big data with history and deliver these remarkable findings.
Yeah, so I mean, the motivation, like Chris summarized it quite well, there's a certain kind of opacity to how we would like ground or anchor exactly how the Irish fared in England. So that was the motivation. And so I've been engaged for many years in building big data to look at processes of inequality and social mobility for the English themselves. But of course, as you get into the 19th century, you see like huge waves of Irish flooding over the Irish Sea to England. And this has been noted by, you know, Adam Smith and Karl Marx at the time. And so growing up from Dublin, I mean, there was this sense of the Irish in England as being perhaps some group that, you know, faced somewhat of an economic hardship, but we can never be precise about it. So this was the motivation. And what we were able to bring to the table were these rather kind of universal records, like literally everyone is in this data. These are all the vital records, birth, marriages and deaths from England from 1838 till just about 10 years ago, like 2007 or so. And we also have wealth and death data. So we're able to track both the wealth of the Irish, but also infant mortality from these vital records. So we're able to get a snapshot, quite an anchored vision of where the Irish are, both in terms of their wealth and their kind of health, the health of their infants, how many are literally surviving that first year of life. And the key element to make this big data, this is like individual name data, and it's the names that we use. So it's quite interesting, because remember, a lot of work on inequality and social mobility is usually based on summary statistics from, say, the Inland Revenue. It doesn't have the individual quality that we've kind of been able to look at here. And when you have the individual level, you can start to ask yourself, well, how are the Murphys, the Kellys, the O'Shaughnessys getting on? And what we've done here is actually group all Irish names together as one distinct group. And what you see when you do that is a picture that we had a feeling about, but we're never able to kind of actually get the actual averages and standard deviations, the change over time. And what you find when you do that is that the Irish are coming in much poorer than the English. Those who remain in England are kind of remaining, like we use the phrase an underclass, and I often have trouble using that phrase, but I'm not too sure exactly what it means. But it means that they're definitely coming in along where the English poor are. And it takes a long time for this process to play out, for the Irish to assimilate to England. And in the data, we see that they eventually do, but it takes like most of the past two centuries. And you see this both for the wealth, as I mentioned, but also for infant mortality. So there's quite a stark story. It's not just, income here. It's also health.
And the headline finding is stark. It's that the Irish were about 50% poorer than the English for much of this period. So I wonder what's driving that gap.
So that's a great question. So first of all, you can describe it. And that's the kind of rather modest primary goal of the paper. And what you see with that gap is that it's primarily concentrated amongst Irish who go to the north of England. The Irish who go to the south of England and London do a lot better. And throughout the island, you can see that Irish infant mortality rates are 25 to 30, 40% higher than the English. And that they all converge over time. But why is that happening is the million dollar question. So all I can offer you is the data to kind of as a platform to ask that question. And there are two hypotheses here. And it could be a mix of both. But one is going to be selection. Who left Ireland? Was it a brain drain of the best and the brightest? Or was it an exodus of, say, working class Irish to those industrializing north of England cities that Engels talked about as being key to the British Industrial Revolution? Were they perhaps lower educated than the average Irish or the native English? So preliminary work and a follow-up paper suggests that it's quite a lot of that is going on. So there's a selection effect. But there's also quite compelling evidence that once the Irish landed in England, which didn't take long, it's very close, our nearest neighbor, and might be perceived as like the one labor market, the Irish were very much the other ethnic group in English history over the past two centuries. So the Irish were a different religion. They were often, caricatured famously as in Punch magazine. And we touch on some of those themes. Chris collected some very compelling information on that in the exhibition. But there's also, an idea that perhaps there was a kind of antipathy or a kind of a discrimination in the labor force against the Irish. So we can't like pin exactly what's going down, but I think those two forces are enough to explain what we see. And, to emphasize, this does melt away. This does melt away in the past few decades. So it's not a contemporary thing. In fact, the contemporary picture is rather the reverse. There's suggestive evidence of particularly recent Irish flows to London. And I perhaps might say that myself, of course, wouldn't I? Tend to be doing very well in a relative elite.
Cormac, I approached this exhibition thinking that it would be a happy story about celebrating successes and achievements, and instead it's a much more nuanced story, and at times it's quite a bleak story.
That's true, and if you come at this from economics, you might be inclined to say, well, there's something wrong here. This is a bit of a puzzle because Migration is about convergence, about catching up. And what our evidence suggests is that this was a very, very, very slow process. I mean, there's some catching up in our data in the immediate wake of the famine. But then for, 150 years or so, the Irish remain, what Neil referred to cautiously as a kind of underclass. And to repeat, in other words, what Neil has been saying, our mission was to present the facts, which I think are new. But I think it is fair to say that nobody before this has, covered such a long period and employed such data to the issue. There have been lots of local studies. There have been studies of the Irish, at different points in time, but not over the long haul. At the end, it's difficult to come up with conclusive, I suppose, explanations for why the Irish found themselves in that situation over such a long time. One could say that at the beginning, they might have been discriminated against, but that would wear out, that would wear thin. The other point to be borne in mind here is that our data refer not just to people who are fresh off the boat. They refer to English people with Irish surnames. In other words, they refer to people of Irish ethnicity, or to be more precise, Irish Catholic ethnicity. So if there is prejudice, and if that is what is revealed by the data, then it's not just against first-generation Irish, it's against people of Irish background, whose grandparents were Irish, And that, you know, that raises a larger issue. And it also makes you think that there must be more to it than discrimination. I think that, again, one of the reasons was that the Irish focused a lot in their initial movement on the north of England, on where the Industrial Revolution was happening. In the 19th century, outside of London, the south of England was a kind of an industrial backwater. The action was all in the north. So the Irish focused on Birmingham and Leeds and Manchester and Liverpool and the northeast and so on. And the thing is, when those areas deindustrialized later, the Irish or their descendants seem to have been reluctant to move out. And so what you're capturing to some extent is people being somehow locked in for economic or for cultural reasons. That remains to be seen. That remained the case until, you know, as Neil said, very recently. The issue of discrimination is also hard to pin down. I mean, that phrase, no Irish need apply, question mark, is one that we don't address in the paper except for about a sentence or two, and it's one that requires more work. I mean, there has been work done by Irish studies people in Britain on the treatment of the Irish over the last half century or so, and there is evidence of a lot of hostility and unpleasant interactions which were magnified by the Troubles. But we're talking not just about the last half century, we're talking about a much longer period. So the challenge to explain what happened is a larger one.
And Cormac, do you think that this is a different story from the story of the Irish in America? And if we were to apply the same methodology and approach there, would we get different results and findings?
Well, the story of the Irish in America used to be the story that we have been telling about England. The initial historiography of the Irish in America was pessimistic. One only has to think of Oscar Hanlon, who wrote a book about the Boston Irish, and then after that he wrote a classic about immigrants into the US. And the people who fare worse, according to Hanlon, in the 19th century were the Irish. They stuck to the menial jobs. They were not liked. They were, again, discriminated against and so on. So the story that Hanlon tells about the Irish in America, it's a lot like what we find. But more recent work on the Irish in America is more optimistic. And there is evidence when you follow people through over time, and one can do that now through linking people in the census, one does see over the life cycle, not that everybody moves up, but there is, on average, upward mobility. And, of course, over a longer period, like the 100-150-year period that we talk about in Britain, the Irish have done better, and they're certainly not at the top in the US now. People of Irish background, people of self-declared Irish background, fare much better than the average, and that cannot be said yet of the Irish in Britain.
Christopher, tell me about this 1965 documentary, The Irishmen, An Impression of Exile, because it seems a very powerful telling of the story, interviewing people, and then it seems to have been controversial at the time.
That's right. So Philip Donlan, who is of Irish descent himself, was a documentary filmmaker for the BBC. He made sort of social realist documentaries in the early years of BBC TV. And along with Seamus Ennis, the traditional musician who worked as a journalist for the BBC at the same time, had a very famous radio show tracking traditional music around Britain and Ireland. He made this film called The Irishmen, An Impression of Exile, which follows Irish migrant labourers going from Ireland over to England in the mid-60s and talks to many people of different ages who've had the experience through the post-war years, which obviously the 1950s saw an enormous wave of emigration from Ireland over to England to work on the reconstruction of Britain after the Second World War. And the film, it's really an extraordinary piece of work. It includes a lot of pioneering filmmaking techniques. There's incredible footage of Irish migrant labourers working on the tunnels under London. There's some incredible musical sequences, and there's traditional music provided by people like Joe Heaney, Seamus Ennis indeed, and songs written by Ewan McCall. But you're absolutely right, the film was not shown at the time. The BBC told Philip Donlan that it was boring and pretentious, which he took to mean that they were looking for an excuse not to show it because of some of the things that the migrant laborers say in the interviews that he does with them, which are often very angry about their experience in England, very angry about their experience of having to leave Ireland. And it was one of those interviews that first struck me and sort of made me take notice of the film, where there's a man talking about how his first experience of going to England was that it was a sort of a very lonely place for the Irish people after the war, and that, you know, they were treated very poorly and their work wasn't respected, and it was a very difficult place to go. But at the same time, there was nothing for them in Ireland and they had to leave, and there must be something wrong with Ireland that such a huge number of people constantly have to leave. And it really resonated with me. My own grandparents left in the 1930s and made a life for themselves in England, and I would say had a very positive view of their lives in England in the sense of the opportunity that it gave them, the work opportunities that it gave them. My grandmother first working as a nurse, my grandfather in construction, and then in a factory. But they also had many stories of how Irish people were treated in England that were less positive. And so I kind of was in some ways hearing my own grandparents' voices in some of those interviews. And so we collaborated with the filmmaker's daughter, Philippa Donlan, who's a dancer and choreographer, and with the Irish Film Institute to bring the entire film to our exhibition, because it's something that really hasn't been shown much in the last 60 years since it was made. And I think that that's a great shame, because it's a extraordinary piece of work that gives voice to a lot of the people behind the research that Neil and Cormac have been talking about, in the sense of people who very clearly had reasons to migrate. You know, they're very explicit about the fact that there was nothing for them in Ireland. There's no romanticization, even in some beautiful scenes of a young man leaving Connemara, leaving his family, going over to England. You know, nobody is saying that they kind of wanted to stay at home, because they are very clear that there's nothing for them there. And they talk in England about what an enormous amount of work there is. I think that's something that's very clear, and that's something that would have been true at different periods. Obviously, when there was work available in England, when there was economic opportunity there, that's why people were going. And being able to hear those people's voices, I think, gives a real richness and a human side to the exhibition. And I think contrasting the big data with those direct voices, and indeed the music, which provides and sort of a more visceral experience of the connection between the two countries and that hybrid culture that has developed, I think is very powerful.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the economic history of the Irish in England. We'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, I'll be talking to Professor Louise Ryan of London Metropolitan University about the experiences of Irish women in England and their contributions to the NHS. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we're talking about the economic history of the Irish in England, inspired by a wonderful new epic exhibition, No Irish Need Apply. And I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Louise Ryan, Senior Professor of Sociology at London Metropolitan University and Director of the Global Diversities and Inequalities Research Centre there. And she's the author of the book Social Networks and Migration, and the co-author of Irish Nurses in the NHS and Oral History. Louise, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Patrick. My pleasure to be here.
Can I begin with the story of Irish nurses in Britain? Because I was impressed to read that statistic, that figure, that by the 1960s, almost 30,000 Irish-born nurses were working across the NHS, and that's 12% of all of the nursing staff at that time.
Yes, absolutely. It's really important to recognise the enormous contribution that Irish nurses have made to the NHS. And right from the beginning, when the service was established in 1948, you know, the NHS, when you think about it now, it was a really brave project for any government to embark upon, especially in the immediate aftermath of the devastation of World War II. But when the NHS was set up in 1948, it was very quickly apparent that they just didn't have enough staff to run all the hospitals. And so right from the start, they were recruiting overseas for student nurses, and Ireland was the first port of call. So that's the story that we very much wanted to tell in the book, Irish Nurses in the NHS, an Oral History.
And it is a wonderful oral history based on all of those interviews. And given that the NHS is such a beloved and much respected institution in Britain, what were the experiences of these Irish nurses like? Were they accepted, welcomed, loved, respected, or did they experience any anti-Irish prejudice at any turn or any stage?
Yeah, I mean, the experiences of Irish nurses in some ways reflects the wider experiences of Irish migrants in Britain, which, of course, is a theme picked up in the exhibition that's currently on at the Epic Museum. And it's that kind of contradiction about the position of Irish migrants in Britain. On the one hand, very much needed workers actively contributing to the economy, and as we've seen with Irish nurses, being fundamental to the effective delivery of healthcare services in Britain. But on the other hand, with that legacy of colonialism, Irish migrants were still experiencing stereotypes, anti-Irish jokes, mocking, teasing, demeaning, but also at a more extreme end, you know, actually confronting discrimination. And we see that in the stories of the Irish nurses, they navigated those contradictions. They were professionals. They were very well respected in the context of the work they did within hospitals. But in wider British society, they often encountered prejudice and discrimination. And the example that's discussed very much in the book, there are two examples, really. One is about accommodation, the famous no blacks, no Irish, no dogs signs. And the nurses in some ways were protected from that because many of them, at least initially, lived in the nurses' homes attached to hospitals. So they had guaranteed accommodation. And it was usually only when they moved out of the nurses' homes and they were looking for flats or bedsits or accommodation generally in British society that they encountered that antagonism and hostility from landlords. So that was one very marked experience in the book. And the other experience then came a bit later in the 1970s and 80s, associated with the IRA bombing campaign. And in the book, we have some very, very powerful and very moving, actually quite upsetting stories about nurses who were wearing their uniform, they were doing their job, they were delivering vital healthcare, and yet they were still experiencing a backlash around the time of IRA bombs in various cities across Britain. In the book, we have examples from Scotland, from Liverpool, from London, where they encountered patients really being very angry and very negative towards them, precisely because they were Irish and sort of guilty by association at the time of a bomb in that area.
It's interesting when we talk about migration, we sometimes leave Irish migrants out of those discussions. They're almost invisible migrants when we're talking about the experiences of people who come to the UK.
That is very true. And I've been researching Irish migration in Britain now for about 25 years. And an experience that I've had, Patrick, is that when I first started doing my research on Irish migrants, I found that they were often invisible. They were often not discussed in the wider migration literature. And in fact, some people would even say to me, oh, but the Irish, they're not really migrants, are they? And so that partly explains why they're not included in those bigger discussions, even when the numbers would suggest that they absolutely should be part of that conversation. The huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of Irish workers in the British economy, but still not really seen as migrants. And it again goes back to that contradiction. On the one hand, they're seen as being kind of valuable workers who come from not too far away, who primarily speak English as a first language, who are white, who were part of Britain, the colony, the United Kingdom, you know, those blurry boundaries that unfortunately not all British people understand the kind of technicalities of those legal terms and boundaries. So there is that sense of, well, they're not really migrants, are they? But then, on the other hand, as we were discussing in relation to the nurses, when there's a backlash, particularly around the time of the IRA bombings, then they are very clearly identified as outsiders, foreigners, migrants. So it kind of comes in and out of focus at different points in history.
And there kind of is a tension there, or almost even a contradiction, that in some ways they're disadvantaged, in other ways they're upwardly mobile and integrated, in some ways they face discrimination, that they're in that kind of middle ground, and sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't, and it is hard to kind of categorize and interpret it.
Yes, and that's why when we are doing research on migration, we need to be aware of all of those complexities and nuances. Literally, it is not a simplistic black or white issue. There are a lot of shades of grey when we're talking about migration. And so it's really important to have that political lens and to understand how particular groups of people can be welcomed with open arms at one point in time, and then criticised, condemned and rejected at another point in time. That doesn't just apply to the Irish. We've seen that, for example, around Brexit with Eastern Europeans, primarily Polish migrants, who were initially welcomed to Britain as very valuable workers, the kind of stereotype of the Polish plumber, really valuable and welcomed. And then as the years went by, this growing criticism of all these Eastern European workers coming into Britain and that kind of fueling the Brexit debate. One of the factors fueling the Brexit debate and the eventual vote for Brexit was in part, you know, that rejection of all of these European migrants having mobility rights to come to Britain. So in the same way as the Irish, we can see how it changes. It's nuanced, it's multi-layered and it's complicated. And groups are never just one thing. They are never just workers. They are people with families, and they are complex in their positioning within the wider discussion of migration across British society.
It's also fascinating that your own biography kind of reflects this as well. You originally from Cork, now a senior professor in London, one of the most cited scholars globally. And your own trajectory reflects some of these journeys as well, from Ireland to Britain.
Yes, absolutely. And not just me personally, but my family history. And I think like many Irish people, I've been quite obsessed with the release of the Census 1926 data last weekend and looking up my own ancestors. And I come from a very, very working class background. My grandfather was Daniel Ryan. He was a man who had that kind of back and forth migration to Britain over the years. He went back and forth several times. His wife and children were in Cork, in Little Island, and he was going back and forth to do kind of seasonal work as and when he could in Britain. So, you know, he was very much going as that kind of manual labourer, a man who was from a very humble background. And yeah, I come from those origins. That reflects the story of many Irish people. And I suppose growing up in the 70s and 80s in Ireland, I benefited hugely from many of the measures that the Irish government were putting in place at that time. And I was able to advance my education, hugely grateful for the wonderful education that I had in UCC. And then I migrated in the 1990s, you know, pre-Celtic Tiger. So I do map myself and my family history, map onto that wider story of Irish migration back and forth to Britain over the last century or so.
And when you look at that story over that last century or so, how many returns? Because I see that you've written recently about older Irish women migrants and their narratives of non-return. And I wonder what were the stories like in terms of people who settled in the UK and made their new lives and their new home there, and how many then dreamt of a return and how many did return?
Well, I suppose it's the story of migrants from all over the world, not just from Ireland, that dream of returning. Because, of course, logically, when you think about it, if you leave home as a young person, as a teenager or in your early 20s, it's very hard to think, well, this is it now, I'm gone for good. That's a very hard kind of reality to face. So we all go with that sense of, well, I'll be back again. This isn't forever. So many Irish people, of course, not just my grandfather, but many Irish people over the years have gone back and forth. And indeed, when we did the research with the nurses, it was interesting that many of them had also gone back and forth to Ireland at various points in their lives. And indeed, some of them had gone to America and Australia as well, and then returned to Britain or gone back to Ireland. So quite globally mobile. And of course, we know the Irish are very mobile, not just between Ireland and Britain. So, yeah, return, I suppose it's complicated, isn't it, like anything else? It's something that initially seems relatively easy because you're going back home to the familiar, to where you feel a sense of belonging. But as the years go by, that changes. And we know from the oral history research that I've done and other scholars have done that Ireland changed absolutely, almost beyond recognition, during the second half of the 20th century and into the beginning of the 21st century. So for a lot of those Irish migrants from the 50s, 60s and 70s, like our nurses, the Ireland that they were going back to visit was becoming less and less familiar. It was becoming different on so many levels. And the longer that you're away, the harder it is to go back, because then it's not like a return. It's then like a new migration. You almost have to prepare yourself for the fact that you are going to a country which is very different from how you remember it perhaps 50 years earlier when you were a child growing up in that country. Now you're going back as an older person and having to navigate a quite unfamiliar environment, not just in terms of the place or the people, but the institutions and the structures, which are quite different. And it was interesting when we did the interviews with the nurses and that paper that you've mentioned about non-return, what many of those older people said was that when they came back to Ireland for a visit, they found institutions and structures very hard to navigate, like the Irish healthcare system, because it wasn't like the NHS, which they were very familiar with. So they didn't fully understand how it worked or how to navigate it. And so for them, that made them realise how different Ireland was from the way that they'd remembered it in their youth. So, yeah, it's complicated. It is like a new migration.
I'm also interested to see that you've written about other migrants, Polish migrants, French migrants, and migrants from around in different parts of the world. And I wonder, are the Irish migrants different? And in terms of that historic and long-standing and even the geographical relationship between Ireland and Britain, does that change the nature of Irish migration?
That's a very good question. And I suppose it's always tempting to say that a group is unique and special and different. But the research that I do, because I research so many different migrant groups in Britain, you can see differences, certainly, but you can also see similarities. So I mentioned Polish earlier. There are a number of important similarities between Irish migrants and Polish migrants in Britain. And there have been a lot of intermarriages between Irish and Polish people in Britain, largely because they kind of met and socialized around the Catholic Church or around kind of Catholic schools. So that's one commonality. But then when we look at the kind of colonial experience, there are quite a lot of similarities between the Irish and the Caribbean migrants, because they arrived in very large numbers in the late 40s, 50s and 60s. The Irish and the Caribbean migrants often worked together. The women, for example, as nurses, a lot of Caribbean nurses, a lot of Irish nurses working together, living together in the nurses' homes, socializing together. And similarly with the men, a lot of Irish men and Caribbean men would have worked together, for example, in construction, but also in transportation, where trains and buses, where both Caribbean and Irish workers tended to be very highly represented. So we see there that they also had similar challenges around accommodation, finding accommodation, experiencing hostility and animosity in Britain in the 50s and 60s. And they also came speaking English, but having that very complex colonial relationship with Britain as well. So what I find so fascinating about doing research with different migrant groups is to really see how those similarities can play out, sometimes in unexpected ways, but also not discounting the differences that people navigate in their migration lives and their experiences, particularly in relation to work and housing.
Is there any misconceptions about Irish migrants in Britain that you'd like to challenge?
Well, There's one that I've already mentioned, which is the fact that some British people don't always recognise Irish migrants as being migrants and as having some of the challenges that other migrants have. So I think it's important to recognise that the ways in which Irish people's migration history and experiences in Britain have shaped them and how important they are, not just for Irish people, but to the history of Britain and to their economic contribution to Britain. I think the other thing which is important to mention is the diversity of experience of Irish migrants, because it's very important to acknowledge discrimination. It's very important to acknowledge the struggles that some Irish migrants have had, you know, who've ended up doing really hard, low-paid work, such as in construction, where they were often exploited. They had quite a peripatetic lifestyle. Many of them ended up in very poor accommodation. So we have to recognise that. We have to recognise the challenges of ageing and health and loneliness that many older Irish migrants experience. But it's also vital that we don't kind of fall into a very negative discourse which presents Irish migration as overwhelmingly sad. There's a lot of happy stories as well. There's a lot of success stories. And Irish people, in the main, have done very well. And we see that upward mobility in terms of the second generation, but also in terms of first generation migrants who have climbed the ladder. And we've seen that as well with the nurses. They all arrived as student nurses, but many of them, as we discuss in the book, built really successful careers, attaining very senior managerial positions within the NHS. So it's getting the balance right, I think, Patrick, of recognising the struggles and the hardship and ensuring that the needs of Irish people are recognised and met, but also having the confidence to celebrate the successes and the achievements of Irish migrants and being able to appreciate that complex, nuanced and diverse story.
Well, my thanks to Professor Louise Ryan, Senior Professor of Sociology at London Metropolitan University and Director of the Global Diversities and Inequalities Research Centre there. She's the author of many books and articles, including Social Networks and Migration, and is the co-author of Irish Nurses in the NHS and Oral History. We'll be back right after the break as we continue our discussion of the economic history of the Irish in England. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the economic history of the Irish in England. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Professor Neil Cummins, Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics, whose groundbreaking research seeks to generate answers for many of the burning questions regarding the origin of the modern world. And his research has provided much of the big data for this new exhibition. Professor Cormac O'Grawtha, the internationally respected economic historian and Professor Emeritus of Economics at University College Dublin, he's written extensively on a wide range of areas, including the Great Irish Famine, and he co-wrote the article with Neil, which led to this exhibition. And Dr. Christopher Cassan is the Engagement and Impact Lead at the LSE Department of Economic History. He's the creator of this new epic exhibition, which is running until the 30th of June. Christopher, can I ask you how audiences have been reacting to the exhibition? What are they finding? How are they responding to it? Has there been anything in their reactions that has surprised you?
Kind of something that I was super interested in the day that we installed the exhibition. I ended up sort of spending 2 or 3 hours just watching people in the gallery, having spent so long on the design, thinking about how we could guide people through this story. It was really interesting to observe the ways in which they interacted with the material and to speak with many of them. I think that people have been really intrigued by the graphs and the data visualizations and the story that Neil and Cormac's research tells. And people have been very engaged as well by the film. It's very interesting to watch, you know, sort of a lot of contemporary thinking about museums would tell you don't put a 50-minute full-length film in an exhibition because people won't follow it. But you can actually go in and watch people, and they really do sit for a very long time. They're kind of mesmerized in some ways by some of the interviews. I would say that the thing that has struck me most about talking to visitors and receiving their feedback through the feedback form that we have is how personal people's reactions are. Almost everybody who has spoken to me or who has filled in the feedback form has said, my father, my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother or whatever has an experience of this. And I think that's really interesting because it's people experiencing a story that is quite familiar to them in some ways in through a different lens. They might not have had the way to express this longer story, even though their families were a part of it. And I think people find that quite interesting. And I think it says something quite interesting about the way that we try to communicate historical research with the public, because sometimes we are a little bit lacking in confidence of trying to tell stories that people actually will be interested in if we can communicate them in ways that they can understand, because people are quite hungry for hard data, for big stories, for big questions being answered or at least asked. And I found that very striking, that people who have a personal experience, it's not like this subject is totally new to them. You know, we're not talking to them about something that they don't know anything about, but we are telling them a story with material and in a way that they haven't necessarily seen before. And a lot of people said to us, you know, are you really going to put a bunch of graphs up on screens and see how people react to them? And, you know, people actually are very engaged by it. There are ways of communicating these things to a wider audience. It just requires taking the way that we think about teaching, taking the way that we think about our research, and trying to share a story without thinking, oh, well, people will be automatically turned off, because they won't necessarily be turned off if you do it in the right way.
It also shows how academic research can have an enormous impact, and it can be shared with the wider public, and people really do engage with it.
Absolutely. And I think that that's something the team at EPIC have been very clear with us, that one of the things that made them want to host our exhibition was the fact that it was based in such rigorous and groundbreaking research, because they know that their visitors are hungry for that. Their visitors are not just looking for pictures and anecdotes. They're looking for stuff that has a real grounding in historical research. And I think that it's something that researchers need to think more about, is that when you do something that asks a big question or answers a big question, your department should be trying to do things that shares that with a wider audience, with the media, with the public, through whatever means you decide on. But the idea that things should just be published and then, you know, well done, you know, that it's in a journal or whatever, like that, we actually have a lot to say as historians, and the public want to hear what we have to say.
Neil, do you think if you carried out the same research for Scotland and Wales, would you see the same patterns and the same results, or would it be maybe modified slightly?
Well, Patrick, I can speak quite authoritatively to this, as I have done this for Scotland and Wales, and about like maybe 150 different nationalities as well. So there's a related paper like on ethnic inequality in England today, like with the same idea, like I mentioned before, using the names. And names are kind of relatively imperfect. We know there's many kind of names that are shared between different nationalities, like Smith is a popular name in Ireland and England, for example. But there are certain names that just map onto ethnicity very well. Jewish names are that jump out immediately. Also certain Islamic names, Pakistani, Bangladeshi names, but also Scottish and Welsh names. So what you find, just taking the Scots first, the Scots, there's a stunning pattern of the Scots as well, but it's completely the opposite story. And what's happening is there's a exodus from Scotland of what appears to be some sort of very well-to-do managerial class who come to England and die with wealth, almost the mirror image of how the Irish get on. So whatever's happening, internal dynamics in migration, It's completely the mirror image of the Irish migration to England. The Scots is kind of a brain drain, if you will, a classic kind of brain drain, where they're losing maybe their best to the south, and they do very well. The Welsh, I mean, to be quite frank, and I think my interpreting the Welsh, remember, well, Wales itself is in the data. And so the Welsh just look pretty much exactly the same, more or less, as the English. So they're the kind of benchmark, if you will. But the Scots have this huge premium, and the Irish have this huge penalty over time. And just broadening it out, and you didn't ask, but I'm going to presume you're curious, all these other nationalities that you can track over time have a very simple pattern. Any ethnic minority that appears in England before about 1950 that is not Irish tends to be an economic elite. And these are small groups of extremely capable people who end up in London, maybe perhaps through university or professional job or being merchants. So what you see in modern England today is that has completely flipped. And contemporary England today, a lot of migrant groups tend to come in very poor. For example, I just mentioned the Bangladeshi community are coming in very poor. And you can see how that emerges over the past few decades with the changing nature of migration in England. And I think this brings us right back to where we started, because generalizing from the Irish experience, like, it's important for us to understand the history of our people. Remember, Ireland has still not recovered its population from the hit of the Great Famine, right? It initiated many decades, if not a century, of migration, and the population never recovered. So the Irish are in America, as you asked Cormac about, and they're in England, and it's important to know, you know, where we stand. But I think for economics and for understanding the history of migration, the Irish, we've had like a century and a half, if not two centuries, of kind of an experiment to see how an other ethnic group going in huge numbers to a population that was actually quite hostile to them. And that you should, you know, Karl Marx talked about this, the antipathy between the English and Irish working classes. And I think like this is a population that was relatively kind of close, I think, to the native English and did intermarry. We actually have data on that. It's actually it was in one of the earlier appendices to the paper. But it still took most of the past two centuries for the Irish to economically and socially assimilate into being English. And, you know, like I think that has implications for, you know, thinking what's going to happen with contemporary migratory flows.
Christopher, I'll leave the final word to you. It's also a story that shows the extraordinary contribution of Irish women and men to the English economy over all these years through their hard work, through their contribution to culture, political activism and so on. So it's despite being part of that underclass, there are still these remarkable achievements and contributions.
That's right, Patrick. I mean, if you look through sort of any facet of English society now, from politics to trade unions to music to culture, you know, you see Irish surnames. Whether they're first, second, third, fourth, or many more generations. And so the integration of the Irish, the contribution of the Irish to English society is something that needs to be highlighted as well, in terms of an enormous cultural legacy, obviously, in terms of music and arts, but also the contribution that they have made to especially the trade union movement, but even to many of the highest levels of politics on all sides of the divide, because they have become part of English society. And, you know, we have a fun data visualization towards the end of the paper about the Ireland team that played England in the men's European Championships football in 1988, where more than half the team were born in England. Well, when England played Ireland in the UEFA Nations League in 2024, almost half their team and their coach were people of Irish descent or had Irish grandparents or, you know, could have played for Ireland. So the intertwining of the two countries, the intertwining of the two nations is something that's really important. And it is also, I think, vital to highlight the type of work and contribution that Irish migrants and their descendants made in England. I mean, Louise's work on the nurses is something that we highlight in the exhibition through the oral histories that she's done. And, you know, many things, whether it was the NHS, the post-war reconstruction, or indeed, as Neil said, even at the time, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were noting the Industrial Revolution. Those things in England could not have happened without Irish labour, without Irish people emigrating in huge numbers and contributing economically to English society. So that's something that needs to be noted. It's something that the British ambassador, when she launched our exhibition last week, highlighted. And I think it's very timely after sort of a turbulent period in British-Irish relations that, looking towards the future, we actually finally start to look at that story and to tell it.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. The exhibition, No Irish Need Apply? The Economic History of the Irish in England. It's running until the 30th of June in the Epic Museum. Well, my thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Professor Neil Cummins, Professor of Economic History at the London School of Economics, Professor Cormac O'Grawtha, Professor Emeritus of Economics at University College Dublin, Dr. Christopher Cassan, the Engagement and Impact Lead at the LSE Department of Economic History, and he's the curator of this new Epic exhibition. And we also heard from Professor Louise Ryan of London Metropolitan University. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan for bringing everything together. Join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been talking history. Good night.